As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Welcome to the Game Podcast. I'm Gabriel Marcotti, and this week I'm joined on the show by Ollie Kay, Stuart Robson, and Mr. Tom Dart. Today we'll be looking at Manchester City and news that Carlitos Tevez has handed in his transfer request, as well as their 3-1 victory over West Ham. Also in North London Sunday, Spurs hosted Chelsea in another one of those London derbies. And in our debate this week, we'll be focusing on Newcastle United as their eventful week culminates with Alan Pardew enjoying a 3-1 win against Liverpool. So please stay with us for the next 35 minutes or so. All right, let's start with West Ham and City, but not the game perhaps, but of course the big news that came out late Saturday night. And I think which has pretty much sort of dominated the last 48 hours, Carlos Tevez handing in a written transfer request, which I guess has more weight than simply saying, I want to leave, because at least there's evidence of it. Ollie, he cited a whole number of reasons, or rather, there was a whole number of reasons in the News of the World story, which I think we can all agree comes from a source very close to him, if not the player himself. What do you think the real reason is?
I think it's a variety of things. I think the homesickness issue is genuine. He has, you know, he's referred to that in interviews, even when he was known to be happy in England. He was always saying that homesickness and being away from his family was an issue, that he wanted to move back to Argentina at some stage to play for Boca Juniors. He always talked of perhaps even retiring by the time he was 30. So that is an issue. But I mean, when you've got a statement in which he makes pointed reference to senior executives at the club, I think an awful lot of it reflects tensions not between him and Mancini, as was first believed to be the case, but between Keir Jurabchin, his agent, and Gary Cook, the City chief executive. I think that there's been a situation there for a while, and to be honest, it feels a little like Tevez is a pawn in a wider game, which is just unfortunate.
Ollie, I'm going to stay with you because you're up there, you're a little closer to the reporting side of things than the rest of us. One of the lines being spun, and I think which Tevez seemed to sort of address when he said, when he said in a statement, "I resent the notion that I'm somebody's manipulating me," is that Kia used to be a big player at Manchester City with Mansour's billions, and then perhaps with the emergence of Marwood in more the player acquisition role. And of course Mancini coming in and maybe wanting to operate in different markets, he's not as powerful. He's basically just Tevez and Joe's agent now, and nothing more. Does that play into it at all?
Well, when Tevez is talking about relationships with executives, then I mean, he has very little cause to even cross paths with Gary Cook or with, to a lesser extent, with Brian Marwood. His relationship is with his teammates, with the coaching staff, with Roberto Mancini, obviously. And to be honest, it doesn't seem like this should be an issue for Tevez. I mean, who knows whether there's been some grave insult against Tevez's integrity behind the scenes. I suspect not, given that he was talking, given that the club have been saying that he wanted to sign a new contract very recently. But there's so much claim and counterclaim. It's nauseating, really. It's even more than the Rooney case. It just seems to be incredibly adversarial between a player and a club, and the agent on one side, and you're not getting the straight story from either side. I think if people are tempted to take one side or the other in this, they're going to miss a whole load of facts. I think what we're getting is fairly extreme versions of certain truths from both sides, and an awful lot of spin, and we're going to have to just read between the lines on this one, because certainly nobody's telling the whole truth.
For those out there who might not know about his homesickness and the situation with his family, he has a wife, I believe was his childhood sweetheart. He's got two little girls. He had an extramarital issue earlier this year. His wife gave birth to a second daughter in Argentina. They used to live over here in England, and then afterwards they basically stayed there. And I think, you know, the relations are a bit up and down, and it's his private life, and obviously that's his business. But the way I see it, though, if this is the main concern, why he wants to leave, if this is the reason he says, I want to go sort out, you know, my family, we can all be cynical about it now, but if it actually does happen, and he would have to take a huge pay cut for it to happen, then you can tip your hat to him. If, on the other hand, it's all just a ruse and he pops up at Real Madrid in a couple months, then you could kind of probably go and call him a liar. No, Stuart?
Yeah, you're quite right. It's where he goes from here. And how is he going to go back to Argentina? Will the Argentinian clubs be able to pay the transfer fee? Will they be able to pay his wages? I'm sure they won't get anywhere near.
You could work out a deal like they did with Rubinho. You know, I mean, you give City an option on future players, or if there's players that they want, he takes a big pay cut. You know, there are ways, I think, to work that out to some degree. Obviously, he would have to take a huge pay cut to begin with.
Yeah, I mean, it is an issue being homesick. I played, I wouldn't say right up north, but in Coventry, and my family still lived in London, and that was
like an hour and a half away.
But you still couldn't travel home backwards and forwards every day, and that does cause some tension in the end.
What a wuss! You're from Essex,
but
aren't you?
You still couldn't do the travelling every day. How can you travel to training and travel back? You could go back at the weekends.
It's the same thing. You've got Comet and Asda and all those other things you have in Essex.
Homesickness isn't about where you shop. It's about being next to your family all the time, seeing your kids every day. And he's not seeing his kids every day. He's not seeing them probably every 3 months. And when I was playing, you couldn't travel up and down the country. You had to stay in a hotel. The club insisted you stayed in a hotel. I had a row with the club because they were going to buy my house in Essex, because it's when you couldn't sell houses, so that I could move up my family up. And that didn't take place because the chairman changed, and he changed the rule on that. One chairman was going to do it, the next chairman didn't. So I resented Coventry for that, and that became an issue between me and Bobby Gould and the chairman. So that's the sort of thing that can happen when relationships can go sour. If they've promised him one thing, it may have been that he could go home every month or something, and they've changed their mind on that. There's all sorts of issues that can take place when you're trying to negotiate about seeing your family.
There's one of the specific issue with this is that City, because the signing was so significant, because he came from Manchester United, because he was, apart from Rubinho, he was the first real superstar player that they signed, and it was such a sort of groundbreaking deal for City. We had the infamous Welcome to Manchester billboards, etc. I think they've almost encouraged Tevez to see himself as the sort of spiritual leader of the club, or the sort of, at least, you know, if one person was going to be bigger than the club, I think it's him. Certainly more than Rooney at United. And for him to leave, or for him to rock the boat in this way, I think it does cause City a big, big problem.
Tom, they didn't just sit around and argue over contracts this weekend at City. They actually went away to West Ham. It wasn't Save Our Season Day at West Ham, which may explain why West Ham lost. But what do you make of City? Because I thought this, unless I'm mistaken, I think this is their one big win without Carlos Tevez. Was it a case of City being impressive, or a case of West Ham being very poor again?
A bit of both. City were efficient, quite fluid. It's pretty easy to look good against West Ham, though, especially when you've got that level of attacking talent up against West Ham's defence. City carved apart West Ham by and large with ease. There was a period in the second half when West Ham did look pretty spirited, which, if I was Avram Grant, I'd be cherishing that moment of that, the memory of that 10 or 15 minutes when West Ham threatened to equalise, but they had no way of coping with Yaya Toure, and if I was Mancini, I'd be certainly looking in the absence of Tevez to get Yaya Toure further and further forward, because he looks like he's got the pace and the power and the finishing ability to weigh in with quite a few goals.
Okay, this is interesting because Tom Dart here, and you know, I'll mark the time on the calendar, said, you know, Yaya Toure has the pace, power, and finishing ability to score goals, and he should be playing further up the pitch. Now, for much of the season, all I got is, oh, negative Catenaccio Mancini playing three defensive midfielders, Yaya Toure can't play up the pitch, blah, blah, blah. Can he play up the pitch? Is Tom right, or is Tom
absolutely
on powerful hallucinogenic drugs?
Absolutely. On Saturday, you know, and I've been critical of Manchester City, particularly when I saw them against Manchester United and I saw them against Chelsea. They defended well all around the pitch, but they didn't have any. They didn't try and attack with any sort of fluency and didn't get players forward. At times on Saturday, they played with four strikers. West Ham were on the edge of Man City's box, and on the halfway line, there was four Manchester City players. David Silva, Balotelli, Joe, and Yaya Toure. Yaya Toure almost played as a centre forward, a second centre forward. At times he did drift back when they'd already won the game. He started to drop back and get the ball, and then the other two midfield players went beyond him. But their movement up front was brilliant. You could tell me, if anybody could tell me where David Silva was playing, I think you'd be a liar, because he played here, there, and everywhere. Joe and Balotelli kept on swapping positions. I thought their movement and fluency and link up play was absolutely brilliant on Saturday.
Ollie, this kind of movement and fluency that Stuart talks about, is this all sort of managerial tactical genius, or is it just kind of like the manager saying, you know, you front four, you guys just try not to get into each other's way and move about the pitch, and they're rubbish anyway, and just keep the ball and score?
Well, I think Mancini certainly should take a lot of credit for the way they've played the last sort of 4 or 5 weeks or so. They've probably played as well as anyone in the country in that period. But if you look at the players they signed, the players they signed this summer in particular, you look at Milner, Silva. I know Milner didn't start, and I know Adam Johnson didn't start the other day, but there seems to be an emphasis on more fluidity, more sort of versatility, so that they can maybe change things during the match, change the system, even sort of people swap sides and so on. It just seems like it's more of a fluid team than people realise. If you look at the back six or seven in terms of the, you know, the back four, the goalkeeper and the two defensive midfielders, that is that tends to be pretty rigid. But the players further forward, they all have license almost to go where they like, and it works. There have been occasions in home matches, particularly where they've struggled to break teams down, but their away form has been fantastic.
Tom, you know, people always go out and talk about who the next manager is going to be sacked and so on. Avram Grant at the bottom seems to be getting very, very little love. Did you see any signs out there? Was there any talk afterwards? Do you have any particular insight on whether Avram's going to it's going to last much longer?
Well, certainly Avram was talking about spending money in January and having meetings with the board to get money and spend. There was no sense from what he said that he was expecting. The bullet in his body language was no different to previous games, really.
His body language is generally all the same, right?
Yeah.
It's just him in his black shirt.
But he was no more depressed and gloomy than he usually is. So that's maybe the best we can say. That said, there is a gap opening up now, and you look at West Ham's next games, Blackburn, Everton, Fulham, Wolves, between now and New Year's Day. And if West Ham cannot win two of those games, then this will be a side that is going to get relegated, because it will not be able to beat the sides above them. You can forgive them losing to Man City, because most people do, and Man City went joint top. And the nature of the performance wasn't that unencouraging in terms of spirit, but there's just no one's scoring the goals. The defence doesn't look like it's got a clue. There's no overall tactical vision, it seems to me. There's no enormous team spirit. There's no, apart from Scott Parker. But Scott Parker is now doing everything and showing what a great player he is, because he's taking on the mantle for being the defensive midfielder and the attacking midfielder. He's at the back and he's up front shooting and tackling, because no one else is really. And yeah, so certainly some people inside the club think that he's going to Tottenham in January, and if he does, well, Avram Grant could have $10 million to spend and sign three new players, but if they lose Scott Parker, there really is no hope, because he is at the moment not only the best player but also a symbol of determination and energy and effort, which is sorely lacking from the rest of them.
Did you think Avram Grant will be signing the players, or because the impression I had over the summer is that David Sullivan has and his son have a very active role in sort of, you know, talking to scouts directly and really, you know, doubling up as owner, director of football.
But do they actually talk to scouts? I thought it was Barry Silkman that did most of the transfer deals. Whenever you see a picture of Sullivan and Gold, Barry Silkman's not far away. And that's a worrying way to go. If you're now just buying players off agents or getting agents' recommendations, you know, it's the wrong way to go. You must have a scouting system that you're looking all around the world. You're looking at players six or seven, not just saying, well, who's available? Who can you get for us? Who's Barry Silkman's who's on his books? Well, we buy those. You know, look at some of the signings he had at the end of last season that have never really played. You know, it's a shocking way to go. And you said it quite right. There's no tactical vision at West Ham at the moment. I saw it in the first game. They said, I cannot tell you what they're trying to do, what their game plan is. They had that 10-minute spell which you talked about, where they actually said, and Wally Downs came out and everyone going, let's go long, let's try and get it into Carlton Cole, let's try and get it into Abena and Pickett. I think they all three were on the field at the same, and let's play from there. And they kept the ball in Man City's half. And you could think, well, okay, now it's not an ideal way of playing in terms of long ball, but at least you've got a structure to your game plan. In the first half, and for most of the game, you know, they were throwing the ball out and there was nobody in the fullback was isolated and they had the ball taken off him. The couple of times they threw it into Scott Parker in midfield and there was no one around him, so he got challenged. There was no game plan whatsoever. And if you're going to have any chance of survival, you have to have a basic game plan and then play from there, and West Ham haven't got that at the moment.
Blackpool have worse players and a worse defence in theory, but they have a game plan. Players will bought into their manager's tactics,
exactly,
and they play like a team.
Moving on to the other big game, Spurs go out, they take the lead, Michael Dawson's back, and Chelsea are in crisis. And what struck me was, you know, you get the early goal. I kind of would have expected more from Spurs, like a better ability to keep control of the game. Instead, I saw at the end, Chelsea had 60% of the possession. They had a lot more shots on goal. Stuart, from a tactical coaching perspective, if you were Spurs, how should you have played? I mean, what would you have done once you've got that early lead to keep control of the game and not let Chelsea back in?
Well, the one thing that Tottenham played with was two centre-forwards. Now, if you play with two centre-forwards, you've got to play quickly into the front players, because if you allow the opposition to start to take control, they've got 3-2 in central midfield. They're going to dominate the game. And that's Spurs allowed Chelsea to get back in the game. And in the end, Chelsea, I thought, were the better team in terms of their passing and their movement and their creativity. So I think that's where Tottenham went wrong. They should have used the front players more. They should have played the game or tried to play the game in Chelsea's half. But when they lost possession, their midfield dropped off. They allowed Chelsea to start to dictate the play. And that was always going to be a problem. And I always felt that Chelsea would get back into the game.
Tom, is this something that you blame the manager for?
No, I don't think so. And Spurs have great trouble keeping clean sheets, and I think they've kept a clean sheet since August. Their problem was just not scoring their second goal when they were on top in the first half, just after they scored the first. And there were a couple of moments when brilliant last-ditch tackles from John Terry stopped Jermaine Defoe from getting through. Pavlyuchenko had a couple of half chances. Bale maybe didn't quite get the pass the last man and get the cross in. They came, even though they only had one shot on target in the match, Spurs in that first half came close to creating another really good opportunity to score the second goal, which might then have caused Chelsea to implode, and Spurs could have gone on and won one more comfortably. It was just an incredibly open game, and it's one of those games where you just have to, you know, admire the pace and the skill and the excitement.
All right, Ollie, was it a case of Spurs screwing up and letting Chelsea back in, or was it a case of Chelsea just being too good? I mean, I think we heard Tom's view, we heard Stewart's view. Like Sepp Blatter, you have the casting vote.
Well, I think if you look at Chelsea's two previous away defeats at Birmingham and at Liverpool, they conceded early goals in both of those games and then had the majority of the possession in the second half. But in those two games, they didn't show as much sort of vigour and self-belief as they seem to show, and quality as they seem to show in the second half yesterday. I thought they played really well in the second half yesterday. I thought had they not got the goal, that would have been I think that would probably have left them devastated, really, because to have played that well and not got anything out of the game would have been very difficult for them to take after the results they've had. I mean, if you look at the way Tottenham have played the last...
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on. Settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books. Contacts. Calendar. Double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
The last 12 months, really. I mean, the way they play is set in stone. They try to pass it through midfield and get the ball forward to the front players, and generally it's 4-4-2 and it works very well. And I think Chelsea 2 weeks ago maybe wouldn't have dealt with that as well as they did yesterday. I thought it was encouraging, and I didn't really see much criticism to make of the two teams. I could criticise some of the defending, I could criticise some of the midfield play, but I would say that the two teams both played quite encouragingly.
Tom, Ancelotti drops Drogba. Officially, it was because of he felt that against those defenders, Anelka would be more appropriate playing up front. My understanding is that he didn't like the way, when things got bad against Everton, they resorted to hitting long balls towards Drogba, and Drogba right now isn't the kind of Drogba who can hold them up and really thrive on those long balls like he might have done a few years ago. Then the guy comes on. I mean, would you have, does it send a message? Is there, would you have dropped your star center forward in a game like this? Did he get it right?
He did get it right. I mean, Drogba made a difference in the second half, but against Marseille last Wednesday, Drogba was just awful. And if you're Ancelotti needing a result in this game, you just can't pick a player who's been so poor for the past month, no matter how good he's been for you in the past. I think without Lampard there, it's perhaps not the accurate service to Drogba and the interplay between the forwards and the midfield that you would normally get if Lampard is there and on his game. And when you have Lampard there with Drogba, that will make Chelsea much more effective. Perhaps that's been a factor in why Drogba hasn't looked so good in the past month. Then you have the malaria, but also you have he seems to be kind of consumed by his own ego is the right word, but you know, the way he celebrated that goal afterwards, it was as if he was making a point to Ancelotti that, oh, this is Drogba, he should have been on the pitch, footing on the bench, hadn't really given him the kick at the backside, and then coming on to score just reinforced Drogba's apparently unshakable belief in his own self-worth.
Sure, isn't it good if you've got players with unshakable belief in their own
self-worth?
It is
good, but I think Tom's right. I think Ancelotti didn't do it for tactical reasons, as he said. He did it to give Drogba a kick up the backside. You haven't been playing well. I don't think you've been working hard enough. I'm going to put other players in the team up front. I think we might cause more problems with their movement rather than you just standing up, not really working up. So when he came on, he had a point to prove, and he proved his point because he started to knock Dawson out the way. He sort of scored a very good goal, missed the penalty, but he looked a totally different player to the one he's been over the last month or so. So Ancelotti's kick up the backside has worked.
Ollie, you get the final word on this. Put on your clairvoyant hat and please give us the sort of the medium-term view for Chelsea and whether Frank Lampard's return can make a difference and keep Chelsea as contenders or indeed lift them to favourites.
I think they'll definitely be better off with Lampard there. I think he gives them more thrust from midfield. I think Essien wasn't at his best yesterday and he will presumably get back towards something like his best form in the next few weeks. You would imagine Drogba will too. So I can see things improving for Chelsea. There was enough encouragement there in the second half, but their next two games are huge ones: at home to Manchester United and away to Arsenal. I'm not sure, but I wouldn't mind betting that they'll win at least one of those games. But they really do need wins. I think they're unbeaten in three now. But what is it? One win in six, one win in seven. It just isn't good enough. They need to get that momentum back, and I think these next two games, along with yesterday's, will be fairly crucial to that.
In our debate this week, we look at Newcastle United, and obviously quite a week for them. Chris Hughton let go on Monday and replaced not that long afterwards by Alan Pardew. There's a tremendous amount of subtext here, and you've got an active internet and rumors and things doing the round, and Alan Pardew and casinos and things like that, but what interested me most was the line, which I'm sure you guys all saw it. It was in the local paper in Newcastle that tried to explain, if not justify, the decision, which was simply that Chris Hughton is a coach, and what Newcastle needed was a manager. And Alan Pardew is more of a manager, I guess, in the ownership views than Chris Hughton is. Ollie, suspend disbelief a second and say if this is their line of reasoning, then is it a fact that Pardew is more of a manager than Hughton?
Well, I've got to say my first instinct when I saw that line in the paper, which clearly came from the boardroom, was that it seems to be the first time in 3.5 years that, or however long Ashley's been there, that they've actually wanted somebody like that. I think when they got rid of Keegan, it was because Keegan wouldn't fit into their way of doing things, which was to foist players on him and against his wishes, and they didn't seem to be.
Sorry if I jump in there, Ollie, just to complete your thought there. That's back when they had the executive director bracket football unbracket Dennis Wise, right?
Yeah, it is, but there's just complete inconsistency about the whole thing. I mean, what do they want? Are they making it up as they go along? I suspect they are. I think Pardew is a more authoritative figure. People damn him with the thing of, you know, he's a guy who was sacked by Southampton a few months ago, but he is a good manager who perhaps his last two jobs haven't gone as well as he would have hoped. He is a good manager, but undoubtedly he got the job because he was better known to people like Derek Lambias than maybe other out-of-work managers.
Ollie, what makes you say he's a good manager?
I think you look at the work he did at Reading, you look at the work he did at West Ham for 3 out of 3.5 years. I think his record is good. He clearly gets a lot out of players. It didn't work for him at Charlton, but I don't think anything would have worked at Charlton at that particular time when they were in the post-Kirbishley depression. And I think even at Southampton, he seems to have done a decent job. I speak to the odd player who's played under him, and they're always full of praise for him. I mean, I think he's sharp tactically without being necessarily groundbreaking. I think he's authoritative and he's a good motivator. Despite that, I would say that he got the job as a bit of an act of cronyism. But
could you elaborate on that?
Well, there was all this talk last week that he'd got the job because he was casino mate. He was a casino mate of Mike Ashley and Derek Lambias, and he wanted to clarify that at the press conference by saying that he'd only met Derek Lambias 8 or 9 times, and like I say, Lambias doesn't strike me as somebody who moves around constantly in football circles, and I wonder how many other out of work managers, stroke desirable managers, he has met 8 or 9 times. I think to have met Derek Lambias 8 or 9 times and told him, "Oh, you know, I could do a job with that team," probably puts you at an advantage.
Tom.
He seems to be trying to keep a low profile. He's being gentle. He's perhaps learnt from the mistakes of the past, trying to avoid the kind of hubris that he had at West Ham, I think, when he brought a Ferrari and kind of appeared to initiate that baby Bentley culture at the club, which Alan Kirby was so upset about. He was perhaps too caught up in his own self-belief. Pardew, when everything was going well, and then didn't handle it well when his stock fell a bit, when it all came apart pretty rapidly at West Ham. I think he's now slightly older and wiser, but he does still have a great, call it arrogance, call it extreme self-confidence if you want, that will in the end serve him well, allied to, as Ollie said, his solid tactical ability. And clearly his networking ability, which we can't discount.
Well, I just can't see Alan Pardew for the life of me. You know, I'm not sure what he's done in management. I know players that have played under him, particularly at West Ham, who said that he was arrogant, he wasn't a particularly good coach, they played long ball football.
Ollie, if we jump back to the man who laughed, Chris Hughton, I mean, he was a guy that I've met a couple times, and I find him extremely likable. I think for those who weren't paying attention, his results are Newcastle with a bloated, overpaid, generally crummy set of players get relegated. Ashley says, "Oh, I don't really want to spend too much money. Let's just get rid and cut costs and stuff." And they do that. And with the players who are left, many of whom had reputations, but obviously, you know, you would think psychologically in the Championship that it'll be down in the dumps. He makes it work. He gets them promoted. He pushes Andy Carroll and Niall Ranger in into the first team squad, and now he's 12th. So that's sort of a Hughton capsule there. But if you were Ashley and you saw Hughton, and let's assume for a minute that it is true that when it comes to the transfer market, it's not his forte. I mean, there were stories that, you know, he wasn't involved at all in the Hatem Ben Arfa deal, and, you know, didn't have an objection to it, but couldn't really bring anything to the table on it. What would you have done? Would you have tried to get Hughton more involved, give him more powers over who comes in and out? Would you have tried to bring a director of football type or transfer expert to work alongside him, maybe even under him? How would you have? Would you simply have kept Hughton, kept the status quo? What would you have done?
I would have probably kept an open mind on it because they had slipped into a bit of a trough results wise. It was only whatever 4 weeks or 3 or 4 weeks since they'd won at Arsenal and beaten Sunderland, but the results had dipped. So I think there was a cause for just keeping an open mind on it, thinking, what do we do if things continue to deteriorate? But I didn't see a case for sacking Chris Hughton at all. I mean, obviously, I don't see everything that goes on at Newcastle, but having been at their game against Chelsea, I think 8 days before he was sacked, that was not a team that had stopped playing for the manager.
What would you have done about his contract, though? Because obviously it was winding down at the end of the season.
I didn't see the fact that his contract was winding down as a problem. I would say that Newcastle have made enough mistakes in the past, long-term appointment mistakes, and maybe this one on a 5.5-year contract will be one of them. But they've made enough mistakes in the past to warrant keeping an open mind on Hughton, looking at his future towards the end of the season, maybe then deciding, you know, give him an extra year, give him a rolling contract, whatever. I think what they could have done is given him a better pay deal, because I think he's one of the worst paid managers in the Premier League. But then if you give him a pay rise but no extension to the contract, does that create more uncertainty? Does it create more questions than answers? I don't know. But as I said, an open mind would have been fine, but it seems like they had a closed mind about him. It seems like they just wanted to sack him at the first sign of trouble.
I want to throw one other thing out there. I kind of got the sense that, you know, while Ashley, I mean, the line from George Culkin and others up there who know the club well was that it's not as if Ashley lost interest in the club and the club weren't officially for sale, but if somebody came in with an offer, he wouldn't mind somebody taking the club off his hands. Should we read this as the fact that maybe Mike Ashley's interest in the club is somehow stoked again, maybe because they're back in the Premier League, and he's now going to be more involved and more present and presumably put more money in. And if so, is that a good thing or a bad thing? Tom?
I think that's right. Now they're back in the Premier League and doing pretty well, it would be only natural for the owner to want to go to the games and perhaps enjoy the success, having suffered
but if he just gets abused at every game, well, I mean, it's
not, not enjoyable, is it?
Yeah. He might be a masochist of some kind.
Maybe enjoy the success from behind a glass box and lots of security. Yeah, I think Ashley has tried to sell the club twice and failed. He clearly cannot get the price that he wants for the club. Maybe he believes that the more hands-on he gets, the better Newcastle will do. Maybe he's got that self-belief, and then therefore eventually the club will be worth more. Maybe he feels that, but it does seem like Newcastle fans are stuck with him for the short to medium term at least.
All right, time now for some quick hits. Liverpool lose 3-1 at Newcastle. There's false internet rumors suggesting that Roy Hodgson's quitting. Torres gets abused by Joey Barton, who, well, I think you can go and watch the clips for yourself. Ollie, what's wrong? I thought Roy was slowly turning things around. Is this just a blip?
Well, no, I think it's been one step forward, one step back with Liverpool for the last couple of weeks. It's been, there's no consistency there, really. There's been a lot of poor performances. I didn't think for the first hour on Saturday they were too bad, but there's just no real belief, real conviction around the team, and that's the worrying thing.
Staying on Merseyside, a week after holding Chelsea to a 0-0 draw, Everton absolutely stink it up at home, and they're held 0-0 by Wigan. Stuart, which is the real Everton, and why is Moyes finding it so difficult this season?
Well, when I look at their back players and their midfield players, I think they're still a top 6-7 side, but it's in the front areas they're struggling. Luis Sahar hasn't been at his best. Yakubu's started to play well and then got out injured, and they've had Cahill playing up front. If they can get confidence around the goal, Beckford's been a real disappointment for them. They need to work harder in the front areas. That's where they're causing themselves problems, just the front areas. Everything else is okay.
Villa beat West Brom, halting a run of four consecutive losses, but there are reports of a bust-up between Gerard Houllier and Richard Dunn. Tom, Houllier's had injuries, he's played the kid, some of his veterans have been awful. Are these sufficient mitigating circumstances for you to say that he was still the right appointment?
No, not for me. Even allowing for the almost certainty that Villa would decline after O'Neill left, because they've hit the glass ceiling and the only way was down, they've still been much worse than I was expecting. And it's not just Richard Dunn. There's John Carew. There's Stephen Ireland, £8 million signing, £65,000 a week. Should be one of the most talented players in the Premier League. Appears to have vanished. There's plenty of problems here.
Bolton win again, defeating Blackburn and hanging on to sixth place. Ollie, Owen Coyle has changed the club's style and he's done it on a relative shoestring. Do you think he'll be managing a bigger club in 2 years' time?
Yes, I do. Without wishing to offend Bolton fans, I think they're on that upward curve. But I think his upward curve is steeper, if you like. His reputation is growing by the week. I read a fantastic interview with him in the Sunday Times yesterday, where Jonathan Northcroft, the writer, said he felt like he would run through brick walls after speaking to him. I almost felt like that way after reading it. So the next big job that comes up, if it's in the next few months, I can see it being Owen Coyle's.
You heard it here first, Bolton fans. Enjoy Owen Coyle while you can. Birmingham City lose to Wolves and remain perilously close to the drop zone. In the summer, Alex McLeish replaces small, nippy striker Chucho Benitez with a big, slow one, Nikola Zigic. And then James Fadden got hurt. Is this enough to explain the slide?
That's partly the reason, because Zigic, if he's 6'7" or 6'8", whatever he is, he should be winning balls in the air. He doesn't do that, and he can't run in behind. But I think it's almost second season syndrome. The players aren't working as hard. You know, last season they worked hard all over the field. They closed down. They ran off the ball. They're not doing that so much now. And if they don't do that, they're not a particularly good team.
Interesting. The ex-pro blames the players, while we, the journalists, tend to blame the managers. Stoke are also a different side this year to last year, too, but their league position hasn't changed much. Tom, which Stoke did you like better? And is this about as good as it's going to get?
I don't see too much change between this season and last season, to be honest. Cameron Jones has maybe made a difference up front, but two of their most creative players, you know, Adegun Johnson is always on the bench these days, six successive games on the bench. Tunchai struggles to get in the team. Not too much change. Maybe Etherington's playing better. Is it as good as it's going to get? Yes.
Here's one for you, Gab. Rafa Benitez, Inter, have won just two of their last nine in all competitions. Does his future really hinge on the World Club Cup this week? And who do you think will win it?
That's the message coming from the club, but although my information is a bit different, I think it would be stupid to go and judge him on just two games. I think he's got until February, March to turn it around a little bit in the league and at least get to the quarterfinal of the Champions League. If he screws that up, he's gone. And as for who will win it, I would safely say it's going to be Inter, but I'll be clever because, of course, the champions of South America are also Inter from Porto Alegre. Thanks for hanging with us. We'll be back next week with another episode of The Game. In the meantime, you can go to www.thetimes.co.uk. You'll find all your news, your gossip, your analysis. Also, our web chats. Mine's every Monday. Ollie's is on Wednesdays. And Patty Barclay's is on Tuesdays. You can also follow us on Twitter. And by the way, did you know that The Times actually have two people among the top four most followed UK football journalists? Next week, it's going to be another big one. Chelsea take on Manchester United at Stamford Bridge. And Roy Hodgson takes on his old club, Fulham. Thanks so much for joining us. Till next week.
The train is now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, Road Station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.